For the week of February 4th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 398, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Good job, Sperling.
What do you mean, good job?
Well, last week's show, you couldn't understand me. I couldn't hear you. We couldn't hear our guest. My microphone sucked. Everything was a disaster. And yet somehow you edited it so it sounded like an actual normal show.
Yeah, you know, that was actually very, very difficult. And that's, you know, today when the workers arrived, because they're rebuilding a part of the studio here. And, you know, I'm in this ante room and you can probably hear the echo. But when they showed up and they had paintbrushes, do you know how happy I was? I thought there must be an end here.
That's right. And there's been an end at Sony, right? Kaz Hirai is gone from the head of Sony, which is a big impact on Hollywood because he's been a big supporter of Sony Pictures, which has finally turned around. They got a hit with Jumanji, finally their first big hit in ages. So, you know, he's gone. The new head is Kenichiro Yoshida, and we'll have to see if he's going to support their Hollywood division as much as Kaz did.
Well, and of course, Spider-Man Homecoming was a hit as well.
Absolutely.
So
no, yeah. that was quite a substantial hit.
Yeah, I think at least for me and a couple of folks in the technology world who watched him turn around the PlayStation 4 and the electronics division, there was a bit of a, I don't want to say shock, but a bit of, why is he stepping down now?
Head scratching.
Yes. Not in the media, we noticed.
Yeah, now he's got a lot of time on his hands, so he's probably listening to our show, you know, while wandering the streets of Tokyo. And if he does, what will he be hearing about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll discuss the quietest week of the year at the box office, and we'll also be discussing the reason why, and that's the Super Bowl. That happens during Inside Baseball. But first, we see the Oscar season come into sharper focus with the winner of the Directors Guild taking the lead. During Book Filter, Michael will pitch a book perfect for adaptation by Hollywood or Bollywood. When it comes to sexual misconduct, we'll discover that the entertainment industry's habit of taking advantage of young hopefuls has been going on for a long, long time. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is Maze Runner, The Death Cure. $45 million on the weekend, $180 million worldwide. It's looking to get to about $300 million, just like the first two films. It could be a little hard because it's falling quickly in a lot of territories.
Well, and in China, it was beat out by a Bollywood film, wasn't it?
Well, it was. No shame in that, though. The Bollywood film is a big, big hit. So that's, again, we list the movies in order of the money that they made, but we're looking at worldwide box office. So some might be in five territories, others might be in 50. Some might have been out for months, others might be on their opening weekend. And really, unless two films of very similar nature are opening on the same weekend, you're not really competing with each other. It's just you want to reach an audience. It's true, there's only so many people who can buy tickets. But in general, if you've got a good movie, people may come see it. You're not really competing with that movie down the street. So I wouldn't say that The Maze Runner lost to the other film. I would just say, you know, I mean, they're kind of different, reaching different audiences, I imagine, Maze Runner and the Bollywood film. So, you know, I don't see one as winning versus the other losing. You can have three movies open and do well on a weekend. So, you know, it's just not clicking as much in China.
No, what I think is interesting, though, the one thing it does show is the kind of commonality of star power. And no pun intended, Secret Superstar is the Bollywood film I was referencing that opened in China. And it stars Aamir Khan. And he was, of course, in the big movie the big Bollywood movie Dangal, which set a record in China last year for, a foreign film. And by foreign, I mean whether it's American or French or from India, an imported film. So it sold $190 million in ticket sales in China last year. And of course, China alone, yes. And
yeah.
Aamir Khan was the star. And of course, here he is in Secret Superstar. And of course, everybody who saw him last year in Dangal wants to race out and go see him.
Well, he's been in lots of movies. He's one of the biggest Indian stars of all time. He has a number of films that have broken the 100 crore, if I'm saying the currency correct.
Yes.
But you know, he just has like five or six films that have broken certain levels of popularity, not just this film, which was done with the same director of that movie, Dangal. So he is a big, he's, you know, Tom Cruise or Tom Hanks or whoever you want to think of, in or Will Smith of Indian box office right now. He is a huge, huge star. No doubt about that. And of course, Maze Runner was here in North America. It fell hard, but this is the weekend of the Super Bowl, so there's very little happening in the U.S. But movies are still making money around the world. Hugh Jackman's The Greatest Showman made $24 million on the weekend. It's just about to pass the $300 million mark worldwide. And number three is that Sony film we were talking about, Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. $23 million on the weekend, $850 million worldwide. And number four is The Post, the Spielberg film. It's about time we have to say, you know, it's going to do okay. It cost $50 million to make. This weekend, it made $15 million, and it passed the $100 million mark. It's probably going to triple its budget, but that budget has a big asterisk by it since it was directed by Spielberg and stars Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. Clearly, that budget involves a lot of, you know, delayed payments to those stars. So any money they make, those people are going to get first. This is certainly not a big success story. It's fine. They claim to have made it for a price. It's going to be profitable. It's made for adults. It's going to be just okay, but it's certainly not a big, big win commercially for Spielberg and his team. And number five is a French film called The Magic Touch, or The Magic Touche, I guess is how you say it. In France, I believe it's called Le Touche 3, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité Touche. It's just, you know, it's lots of plays on the name of this family. It's the third film in a series. In the first film, they won the lottery, sort of like tacky poor people winning the lottery, ha, ha, ha. In the second film, the son came to America. In the third film, the dad runs for office and he becomes the leader of the country. And they're tacky and embarrassing. $14 million on its opening week, and it probably costs about $14 million to make. So they're going to be doing well as well. Well as well? Is that what I want to say? I don't think that's what I want to say. At number six is Coco, the Disney Pixar film, just hit the $700 million mark worldwide. At number seven is Den of Thieves, the action film here in the U.S., $11 million on the weekend, $45 million in counting. Right below that is Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri, certainly an Oscar hopeful, $11 million on the weekend. Heck, if it made that, you know, on opening weekend, that would have been awesome. But this is weeks into its run. It's made $87 million worldwide. This is a big success story for an adult film with a modest budget.
You said adult film.
And nine is the Liam Neeson flick Commuter, another $10 million on the weekend. That's at $85 million worldwide. And the movie you mentioned, the Indian film Secret Superstar, playing now in China, $10 million on this weekend, $111 million worldwide. That's making a lot of money.
You know, I wonder if another Indian film will even be imported into China, let alone, you know, be a big hit in China. And that is a film that is opening this week in India, and that is Padman.
And why do you question whether that will play in China?
Do you know what it's about?
I do not.
Okay, it is about a man who goes around delivering feminine hygiene products, thus the name Padman.
Would China object to it on think it's too tacky or culturally insensitive? What?
I just think it's an interesting and kind of humorous premise for a movie.
Okay. I think the Chinese like broad comedy as much as the rest of us. Okay. And they also like epic dramas about lovers. A Chinese film just opened up, To the End of the World. It's a movie, well, it grossed $10 million on the weekend. I think it opened on a Wednesday or something because its total is $11 million. It's a serious drama. I found the trailer on YouTube because I couldn't find any info anywhere else. It has English subtitles. I was, oh, great. You know, I watched it. I still really don't know what the movie's about. They're young lovers. The woman is beautiful. The man is tragic and heroic. He seems to be going off to try and rescue something to help get her. She seems to be going somewhere else to rescue him. They're both gorgeous. It's an icy wilderness. They're trapped. They're alone. They're isolated. That's all I got. I have no idea like where they're doing there, what's going on. I watched it three times. I'm puzzled. If you know what the heck Till the End of the World is about, call us.
Yes, you can call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also write to us. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Now, you know, Michael, one of the things you said you couldn't understand what that movie Till the End of the World was about. A couple of weeks ago, Chris Aronson was giving a talk, kind of an interview at the ICTA. And he kind of lamented the fact that when they brought over Alien Covenant, the film was edited so severely that there were like two or three shots of the alien. So in the end, you couldn't understand what was going on.
Is this for what market?
Sorry, this is in China, of course, because Till the End of the World is in China.
So they were cutting back on the violence? They thought it was too violent?
I guess it was too violent, too scary. You know, the censors basically edited the film in such a way that...
Too much alien.
Yeah, he said in the end, no wonder the film didn't do well there. There were like three or four shots of the alien, and that was pretty much what the whole movie was about.
What's his explanation for why it didn't do well everywhere else?
Ouch! It was just a bad movie.
I haven't seen it.
Neither have I.
I haven't seen it, so there you go. Right below that is Darkest Hour, another small flick doing really well. This is the Gary Oldman film about Winston Churchill. $10 million on the weekend, $115 million worldwide, and a thumbs up from my mom. I took her to see it. She's a big Anglophile, but I picked her up afterwards, and she said, take me to the nearest recruitment office. I want to sign up for the British military. She said, I am so roused by this film. I doubt she'll go see Winchester, even though she certainly likes Helen Mirren. This is the horror flick about the family that created the Winchester rifle and then felt haunted by the violence they had created. It opened to $9 million here in North America, as well as dreadful, dreadful reviews and a big shoulder shrug from everyone going, what the heck was that?
Well, you know, apparently, and not apparently, it's true, this story of, you know, Helen Mirren plays the heir of the Winchester fortune, and she actually, this woman in the early 1900s built this house, and she kept rebuilding it and rebuilding it and rebuilding it, and it's in San Jose, California, and it's known as one of the strangest haunted houses going.
Well, it's a tourist site. It's a very weird, you know, you have stairs leading up to nowhere, maze-like places in the house to sort of fool the spirits, they thought, but it's a weird, odd house to go wandering around through. It sounds kind of fun. I've always wanted to stop there. Right up next is Guillermo del Toro's Oscar hopeful, The Shape of Water, $8 million on the weekend, $65 million worldwide. Ding, ding, ding. He has his second or third big hit film of his career. Below that, another sort of horror flick, Insidious, The Last Key. That passed the $150 million mark. 12 Strong is right there below that. $7 million on the weekend for the Afghanistan war film. $46 million worldwide. Ferdinand, the animated film about a bull who doesn't want to fight. $270 million worldwide, which is almost as much as Wonder, the tinier film about a little boy going to school. $6 million on the weekend. $280 million worldwide. Some other Oscar hopefuls, Hostels, did not get any nominations, but it had some good reviews. That opened wide. It's at $21 million. The Daniel Day-Lewis film, Phantom of Thread, that is not going to capitalize on Oscar. It is, you know, clearly not a commercial flick. It made $5 million on the weekend in 22 territories. It's at $17 million worldwide. I kind of admire it. I do definitely want to see it again before it disappears from theaters, but that's not going to set anybody's heart on fire as far as the box office is concerned. Star Wars is still raking it in, but below that is Padmavat. And again, it's so hard to figure out sometimes what movies are making worldwide. I had a good track last weekend on the movie, but this weekend, ComScore dropped the ball again, and I wasn't able to get more info from other sources to figure out where it's at. I think it's at about $45 million worldwide.
Well, you said The Phantom Thread is not going to make any money, and I would tend to agree with you given that it's made $17.3 million worldwide already. It costs $35 to make. But The Shape of Water, you know, as you say, Guillermo del Toro's big hit film. Well, I guess it's one of three big hit films that he's had in his career. And it might stick around for a while since he just won the Directors Guild of America award.
That's right. That certainly makes him a front runner for the Oscar. They won the PGA award a few weeks ago. Now they've won the DGA award, along with Jordan Peele, who won Best Debut for his horror flick Get Out. So, you know. Yes, The Shape of Water won the DGA and the PGA. So did La La Land. But really, he definitely is a front runner for Best Director. Almost every time the Best Director winner of the DGA award goes on to win the directing Oscar. So we'll have to see. However, in the last decade, since they've done the preferential ballot, there's been a much bigger split between picture and director. So the fact that he is, you know, very likely to win the Best Director award doesn't mean The Shape of Water has it locked up for Best Picture. In the past decade, picture and director have split four times. That's a lot. I mean, it's only 10 examples, but there's only like 70 or 80 Oscars, so there aren't a lot to pull on in general. But since they've done the preferential ballot, picture and director have not gone lockstep in any way, shape, or form. So you might think Guillermo del Toro has it locked up for best director, though, you know, Greta Gerwig or Jordan Peele could surprise, or frankly, Christopher Nolan. But best picture, I don't know. It's one of those years where, because I don't like the film, it's really hard for me to know how to predict Oscar, because I'm so colored by the fact that I didn't like the movie.
Well, yeah, and what could wind up happening is, let's just do a hypothetical here, and please forgive my math, okay? But you could have 40% of the people pick The Shape of Water as the number one, right? Mm-hmm. And 40% of the people pick, say, Three Billboards as number one. And 10% of the people pick Lady Bird as number one. But all of them pick Get Out as number two. Guess who wins the Best Picture Award?
The film that most people love the most, Get Out.
Correct.
Right, which seems fair to me. I'm fine with preferential ballot. I have no problem with it. And certainly for the animation section, you'll probably see Coco win. That swept the Annie Awards. It won 11 awards, including Best Film, Director, and Writer. On the other hand, the breadwinner did win Best Indie Animated Film. So that still has a hope, of course. But our inside track from people who are actually voting on the Oscars, oh my God, Coco has it locked up.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's like, yeah, this is not, I mean, they may as well just skip that part of the Oscars and hand it to them without mentioning the other. Well, I mean, I'm kidding. But yeah, everybody says the same thing. What's interesting to me, and I did not know this, is that they presented the award to the breadwinner. And when they named the people who produced it, Angelina Jolie was among them. I did not know that.
Neither did I.
So go figure.
Well, you know, a lot of actors like to be involved creatively and make projects happen. It's hard when you're acting. Someone else has to say yes to you unless you make the film happen. So it's nice to have that sort of control in other areas of your career. Certainly, the Césars are in control of celebrating the films of their country. The César nominations came out, and BPM, a film that's one of my favorites of the year, got a ton of nominations, 13 nominations so far. That's about ACT UP France and their activities in Paris during the AIDS crisis. And it's matched by See You Up There, the epic film that was set between World War I and World War II. That also got 13 nominations. So they'll be battling it out sometime soon for the César.
And I would just like to do a special call out to an old friend from Cannes, believe it or not, who you have met, Michael. Fedette Droyaud. I just butchered her name. Fedette. I just know her as Fedette, okay? She always said, look, I want to go off and write films. And she actually did. And she did an adaptation of Grand Corps Malade, which is The Big Sick Body, which was turned into the film Patience. And she is now nominated for a César for Best Adapted Screenplay.
Oh, that's awesome. Congratulations to her. I wonder if it's been optioned by Hollywood, because if it is, that film will be eligible for our other section about reboots, sequels, and spinoffs.
Yes, this is our, you know, although we've decided we're only going to like pick one or two that we really think will make it onto the screen.
No. We're only going to focus on the ones that are making it to the screen. Okay. We're only going to do it if you've actually been greenlit, not like CBS picked up a pilot or somebody's talked about a project that they're interested in, but it's actually coming somewhere soon near. And that's the case for In Search Of. You remember that old TV series hosted by Leonard Nimoy and before him, Rod Serling? It was sort of a faux science-y show, but they focused on silly stuff like Bigfoot and extraterrestrials and things. It had a one foot in actual science and another foot in nonsense. Sort of became what the History Channel is today. And yes, the History Channel is the one that is reviving In Search Of, that fits right alongside all their other schlock that they do. But it's hosted, this is what I think is fun, by Zachary Quinto.
It's Zachary Quinto. Okay.
Quinto, I beg your pardon. And I mean, dear God, man, he played obviously Spock in the Star Trek films. I think this is taking his Leonard Nimoy homage one step too far.
I was thinking the same thing when I saw that story. I was like, really? You're going to do the same television show. You're going to host the same television show that Leonard Nimoy hosted. And you played the same character in Star Trek that Leonard Nimoy played.
Yes, I look forward to Zachary's one-man show about Vincent Van Gogh. But it is a 10-part series, and it debuts on the History Channel later this fall. So is Metropolis. It's a 13-episode prequel drama set in Metropolis, but there's no Superman. It focuses on Lois Lane and Lex Luthor in what sounds to me like some sort of X-Files setup where they are investigating weird phenomena in Metropolis. I don't get it, but Two guys who are behind Gotham are working on it, and it is set up at the DC Digital Streaming Service. This is the fourth series that they're creating for the DC app or streaming service, whatever you want to call it. There's Titans, another live-action show, and two animated series, Harley Quinn and Young Justice Outsiders. So to me, my God, how many streaming services can there be?
Apparently quite a few.
Yeah, well, you know, there's going to be a reckoning, a day of reckoning. Are there really a lot of people who want to stream DC stuff? I mean, you know, DC's got a lot of content, but is there enough to justify, I don't know what they want, $5, $8 a month? It seems very niche to me, and I think there's going to be too many of these, but it'll all work out in the end, I guess.
You know, I think that what people should really do is somebody should come along and then take some of these services, and instead of making them $5 and $3 and $2, just put them all together, and maybe that'll lower the cost of all of them. Like I don't know, like bundle them together.
And then, you'll have like access to a bunch of different stuff for maybe they'll make a little less money up front, but they'll have the chance of a big audience finding them or stumbling on them because they'll have access to them. Whereas now, if I want to watch that Star Trek thing on CBS, I can't because I don't pay for that app. So that show is invisible to me.
You do know I was joking around, right?
No, I think it's a really good idea. We could call it
cable.
yes, there you go, cable.
Yeah. Well, at some point in time, I would say probably 10 years from now, somebody will write a book like along the lines of Not on My Watch, where, you know, everybody said, you know, Hollywood's falling apart, but all the executives said, you know, digital's not going to disrupt Hollywood on my watch. And when that happens, I'm sure, Michael, you will bring it to us during our Book Filter segment. And Book Filter, every week, Michael, you dive into the new releases and bring us a book that's already been published and it's or about to be published and it's ready for its close-up. What have you got for us this week?
This week, you know, I seem to focus a lot on nonfiction. I don't know why that is. To me, the fiction is just easier to spot. So when I'm trying to find something for you, I guess I'm looking for stuff that's a little out of the ordinary or, you know, not a new book by an acclaimed writer. So again, I've got another nonfiction book for you. It's called The Heart is a Shifting Sea, and it's subtitled Love and Marriage in Mumbai. And it's a nonfiction work by a reporter from PBS NewsHour. Her name is Elizabeth Flock, and she looks at three different couples in modern day India. There are obviously three very different couples. One is a young professional couple out in the world, very modern, and yet still there's some tension because the woman in the couple wants her independence. And that's still quite unusual in India to a degree. Obviously, it's a big, huge country with lots of sophisticated people in major cities. So there's a whole range of experience in India. But still, nonetheless, women are slightly held to more traditional roles. There's also a Muslim couple who are desperate to have a child. And finally, the third couple is an actual arranged marriage that evolves into true love. So by looking at these three couples, she looks, of course, at the different ways people are married and fall in love, and also a portrait of modern day India. I think it's getting great reviews. I've just downloaded it. I'm looking forward to checking it out. It looks really promising. I think, you know, we've been talking a lot about the growing Indian population here in the U.S., the market for those films all over the world. I think it's a great project for Hollywood. I also think it'd be a great project for Bollywood. And I actually have a friend that reconnected with me from college who worked with me on the film committee at my University of Florida school days. And he, out of the blue, he's like, hey, how are you? I'm like, hi, how are you? My gosh. I mean, he has credits in India. He's directed films in India. He has an editing credit on a revival of von Stroheim's Greed. When they restored that film in 1999, he was one of the editors working on that. So bizarrely, he has an editing credit on von Stroheim's Greed, which is a little crazy. But I was asking him, I said, is Bollywood considered insensitive, or do people in India roll their eyes if we use that term? He's like, well, yeah, you know, a lot of people complain about it, but then they end up using it themselves anyway.
I was going to say, they're the ones who created it themselves. I mean, they coined that term.
Well, now they've moved on from it. You know, basically the idea is, you know, it was named after Bombay, a colonial name for the city of Mumbai, and that name is gone now. So we don't use that name anymore. So it's sort of a dated word that has vestiges of colonialism. It really should only be used for an Indian film made in the former Bombay, Mumbai. And then it's, you know, technically appropriate at least, but there's lots of films we talk about from India that aren't made there. So we want to make sure if we're talking about Tamil film or something else that we don't use that term. So yeah, he's like, yeah, you know, they sort of don't love it, but they still use it anyway because it's so catchy. But if anybody there is listening, this project would be a great one for you in India as well.
Well, that actually sounds like an interesting book. I know that last week you had a book on Jefferson's Daughters, which was also reviewed in the New York Times. But this is a nonfiction book. Some other nonfiction that we've been covering that I'm sure that reams of books will be written about, although I'm sure that's not what they call libraries of books will be written about, is this current time frame in Hollywood history where sexual misconduct has played such a large role.
That's right. And let's not say Hollywood. Let's say America and the world, because it's not just about Hollywood.
Yes, that is true.
We're not covering all the stuff in other areas, but you know, there are some substantive changes happening. Equity has called for new rules during auditions. They want to make sure there are at least three people in every audition. That means the person auditioning plus two other people. Maybe it's the casting director and an associate. Maybe it's the director and a producer. Maybe it's a director and the casting director. But whatever is going on, you shouldn't be doing auditions where it's just you and a producer, or just you and a director, or just you and the star. That shouldn't be happening. And they're saying, hey, this is the new rules that we should have. So that's cool. Other people, I hope, will embrace that, and that could happen. But our favorite sexual misconduct story of the week took place on March 15th.
What? When?
Yeah, I know. In 1923, our in-house historian, Aaron Rich, forwarded an article to me, the front page of Variety, March 15th, 1923, about sexual misconduct. It's a front page story. The headline is Fake Directors. The subhead is Fake Directors Ask Girls to Disrobe for Measurements. And it's a story about people pretending to be Hollywood producers or directors, and they put an ad saying, we're making a movie, ladies, come on out and audition. And they would come out and audition, and the guys would say, hey, that was great. Now we need to do your measurements. Take off your clothes. This is 95.
I don't mean to laugh, but it's like, yeah, of course, no, that has become like an entire like genre of porn film.
Exactly. 95 years ago, people in Hollywood, legit and non-legit, were taking advantage of young hopefuls who wanted to become a star. So not a lot has changed since then. So thank God we're finally getting to grapple with it. But the idea that that was a front page story almost 100 years ago, wow.
And I can't believe I missed that in the show notes. I should have read that. I didn't see that until you mentioned it just now. I read right over it.
I'm glad you were surprised. Well, I mean, you know, it's not a big deal, of course, because it happened 95 years ago. But still, it's important to remember this has been going on a long time, and we have to tackle it. And it's not going to be easy, and we can't get sick of dealing with it, because it's going to be hard to root it out and get rid of it.
Well, I did notice that you mentioned two words there, big and deal.
I did.
And a couple of weeks ago, when we were talking about, you know, all of the sexual misconduct issues, there was a big news story about John Lasseter, the head of Disney Animation and Pixar. And they are now kind of having over at Disney Animation and Pixar a day of listening to find out really that there's some question as to whether John Lasseter could come back, or if, you know, they're thinking of bringing him back. They're kind of gauging the temperature, right? And a lot of people in the animation community figure this is not going to happen. He cannot come back.
That's amazing. You figure how important and powerful he is and how wildly profitable his presence has been at Disney. You know, you don't want to, there's hundreds, if not thousands of people who create these movies. It's a trust of people, but it's hard to overestimate the importance of that person at the top making things happen. And he's been really, really valuable to Disney, but they confronted him a few years ago and he didn't want to hear it. You know, this is a number of years ago where he was confronted by another top person saying this behavior is inappropriate. He was angry, wouldn't speak to them for days or week, and they clearly backed off and were afraid to deal with it. So, you know, this is not a new problem. They've had issues with him before. And the idea that they would dump him is kind of amazing.
Well, first of all, that top person that approached him, and this was only at Pixar that they did this. They kind of said, okay, let's have a day of listening at Pixar. And they said, okay, what are some of your grievances? What do you like? What do you hate?
John Lasseter.
Yeah. And everybody said, wait, so you love John? Oh, no, you hate John Lasseter. And so Ed Catmull, you know, the big Ed Catmull, he's like one of the chief Doyons over there at Pixar, had to go to John Lasseter and say, hey, listen, you know, we did this day of listening, and here are the grievances everybody has. Well, it's you, actually. It's just you. And so he was furious and wouldn't speak to Ed Catmull for over a week, which you'd think, well, it's only a week, so big deal. But those two work hand in glove. And so it took a while to repair that relationship. And so I don't know that they could really bring Lasseter back, especially since it seems that Pixar kind of knew this about Lasseter at least 8 years ago, that, you know, some of these allegations might be floating out there. And so if Disney kind of ignored them, it would make it seem like, yeah, yeah, we knew about it before. We definitely know about it now. And we didn't care then and we don't care now.
So who's going to rehabilitate him and let him come work for them? How is he going to say, I've learned my lesson, I've gone into therapy, and now I'm at Warner Brothers Animation?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, like something along that. But, you know, he's 61. So
that's maybe, young.
Yeah, he might just take this moment to retire or start his own animation company. And, you know,
he's 61. He's not done.
That's why I'm saying he might start his own animation company.
Yeah. So you don't think another studio will pick him up? Do you think he's too toxic?
For right now, yes. But, you know, never say never.
All right. Go to therapy. Apologize. You're a new person. And have him at board meetings sit with two empty chairs on the left and right of him.
Yeah, well, a couple things, and I know you wanted to move on to Big Deal, Big Whoop, and I kind of have stalled that.
I set you up.
I know that, but I wanted to point out that you brought up the fact that the union should get involved in all of this, and here you have Actors Equity doing just that, as you mentioned before. And, you know, as far as Disney goes, the question is, well, who will take over for John Lasseter? They've kind of left the chair empty while he's on a sabbatical. But the reality is, if he doesn't come back, they need somebody to fill those chairs. And everybody's pointing towards Pete Docter.
Well, that's one possibility. I think the thinking now is he was unique in being able to cover both Disney and Pixar. There are sort of different cultures. That's how they feel, that they want to maintain those separate cultures. And that there will probably be maybe one person in charge of Pixar, another in form of Disney, and they both, meaning the animation sections, and they both report to a top boss. But there's a couple people. The people who worked on Zootopia have been talked about. Pete Docter, of course. There's a lot of talent there. So I don't think they're going to drop the ball because John Lasseter is gone, but he is a talent, so he will be missed, at least creatively.
Well, and think about it this way. He was so important, John Lasseter, that is, to Disney, that he lived in Napa Valley, okay? And every week he would be picked up in a plane, a private plane that Disney owned, because they own like four or five planes. And they brought him to Burbank, and basically the plane was at his disposal, given scheduling.
Well, that's just a sign of the absurd wealth of Hollywood and the distortion of reality that those people live in. I don't think that's a particular comment on him. That, you know, lots of stars and studio chiefs. And
That's exactly why they have those planes. Yes.
Right. Just to indulge those people. It's not because he is so in particular so special. It's just because Hollywood is batshit crazy when it comes to, you know, privilege and wealth and what is reasonable, you know, compensation for people who are making them a lot of money.
Yes, indeed. But I know, Michael, after like three or four times of trying to move us on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story in our Grammy coverage, we didn't get a chance to go deep on the off-the-cuff statement of RIAA head Neil Portnow. When asked about the paucity of women in key positions at labels, behind the boards of studios, and at the Grammys itself, Portnow said women needed to, and this is a quote, step up.
Oh, God. I wanted to say last week, yeah, he's going to walk that comment back real fast. And he did. He tried to.
Yeah, he tried to. You know, it was a rather boneheaded comment, as we just kind of pointed out, and he's paying the price since a petition soon circulated in the music biz with some 10,000 people and now 13,000 people stepping up and telling Portnow he needs to step down, not step up. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. He is not paying a price for a stupid off-the-cuff comment. He's paying a price for a stupid off-the-cuff comment that reflects his idiocy on this issue and a really poor track record of the Grammys and the RIAA and the music industry in general. He's paying the price for bad behavior by all the labels, by the Grammys for years. So he's paying the price, but you know, it's not because he made one little mistake, which he did. If he'd had a good track record making a mistake like that, you'd be able to correct for it and people would accept that. But when you've got a bad history of it, and the Grammys itself, dear God, not inviting Lorde to have a performance was so insane. She should have been the first person you invited, for God's sake. It was just ridiculous. So, you know, it is not because he screwed up briefly in a conversation. It's because they have a really bad track record. There's one female head and one person of color head at record labels, and that's practically it. the paucity of women in the record labels and in studios and engineers and record producers and Grammy nominations and Grammy performances. It's just a terrible track record throughout the entire industry, and Portnow has become the symbol of that.
Now, I'm sure you're using track record as, you know, in its truest form, as opposed to a musical track.
Speaking of tracks, that leads us to compact discs.
Yes, because if a CD is playing in the forest when no one is around, does it actually make any noise? Okay, that is best left to philosophers, but ask a kid that question and they might say the following. What's a CD? The compact disc took another body blow this week. Billboard reports that Best Buy has dumped CDs altogether, and Target might be next if labels don't agree to their new terms. Target is willing to carry CDs for a while, but only if the labels don't ask to get paid until a CD is actually bought. It's almost like consignment. In other words, CDs are so lame, Target will only carry them on consignment. I should read these things. I should read these before actually reading them. They're making the same demand on DVDs and Blu-ray. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Target sold about 500,000 copies of Taylor Swift's new album, Reputation. 500,000 copies were sold at Target alone because they had like a special CD and they're one of the last places you can actually go to buy a CD. So if they're dumping them, you're really in trouble. I mean, when you go to Target or Walmart or whatever, this area that they have for CDs is vanishingly small. I think Target has gone from carrying about 800 titles to down to nearly maybe 100. They have really shrunk their space. So this is, you know, if you can't find them anywhere, you can't buy them.
Yeah, you know, certainly I like CDs. You like CDs, Michael, right?
I love them.
Yeah, although I will tell you that, you know, I find the need to buy them less and less because everything is online. But there's something about being able to hold something in my hand that I like. And I don't know why. It makes me old-fashioned. I realize that. But then I like to write with fountain pens to go, shoot me.
You write with a fountain pen on your screen? That must be terrible for your laptop.
It actually is. Even worse, do you know what I've been doing to my laptop screen? This is a complete non sequitur. I keep touching it, trying to.
I know. You do. Yes, of course.
Trying to like, I'm like, why won't this window close? Oh, actually.
Yeah, you know, I have moved beyond my need to own physical product. I had 5,000-7,000 CDs at one point, hundreds of LPs, thousands of books. And I have shrunk down that a lot. And you know why I had them? Because obviously I love music, but that was the only way you could listen to it. You know, if you didn't own the music, you couldn't just snap your fingers and listen to an album. So it was literally, if you loved music and you wanted access to it and you're a real passionate fan, you had to own them. So, you know, most people had a couple hundred, maybe at the most, maybe 50 really, compact discs. But I had thousands. And now, not everything is on Spotify and these other streaming services. Like jazz music is vanishingly small amount on Spotify. It's really frustrating. But regular new popular music, it's all there. And I've moved beyond the need to buy CDs. So I haven't bought a CD in several years, other than as a gift. So, you know, of course, if no one's buying them, why would they carry them?
Well, do you, you know, I almost don't want to mention this, but it's like, you know, what would happen in the kind of...
There's going to be an electromagnetic pulse, of course. There's going to be some event, and I'll be happy to have the 1,000 CDs I have left in my basement.
Right, exactly. And I don't want to ruin this movie, but I will just go and say, go watch The Book of Eli. And you'll see what happens when basically there's no physical media and people want to know what's in that book. What does that book say
don't
inside it?
Don't watch the movie because it's not good, but anyway.
Oh, I thought it was good.
All right.
I think a lot of people thought it was good. Okay. What's its Rotten Tomatoes score? Just kidding.
Well, yeah, you know, Rotten Tomatoes, we had a little fracas. I didn't put it in the show notes, but there was a Facebook page of people trying to get negative reviews of Black Panther because they were really annoyed and they pretended to be DC fans who hate Marvel. But in fact, they're just like racist idiots, you know, just like the people who swarmed the Hugo Awards to try and throw the votes because too many women were getting, you know, nominations. There weren't enough big, dumb, old fashioned sci-fi books. There were all these intelligent, thoughtful books getting nominations. So they created this Facebook page and tried to get people to write negative reviews on Rotten Tomatoes to drive down the score of Black Panther. But however, Facebook said, yeah, we're going to take your page down. So it is possible to monitor these things and take action and not allow people who haven't seen the movie to rate it, not allow them to organize sort of racist campaigns using your platform, without being responsible for every single thing on your social media site.
Well, you know, first of all, you're right, by the way. Book of Eli on Rotten Tomatoes got 47%. Not that that necessarily means anything. I will say that for some reason, I liked it. I like that film.
Cool.
But, you know, one thing that I could never get with the touch of a button on a compact disc is who wrote the darn song, because I always wanted to know, hey, who wrote that song? And if you listen to Spotify, finding out the answer to that question involves leaving the app and heading to Google or Wikipedia or some other source, just like it would with a compact disc. And yet it's, you know, it seems like it would be so simple, since Spotify pays pennies out to artists and only pennies of that actually make it to the songwriters. That seems pretty tacky of them. And they finally agree. Spotify has added songwriting credits to its desktop platform and will add them to the mobile app soon enough. This item was written by Michael Giltz, by the way, but is the move by Spotify a big deal or a big whoop?
Finally, a credit for the text that I write for the show. All this spontaneous off-the-cuff improvisation, no, it is tightly scripted down to the every and But anyway, it's a big deal. It's important. It's useful. They should do it. There's no reason not to do it. Though your comment about compact discs is bizarre, since they usually come with liner notes, a little booklet, and on the CD itself, usually are songwriting credits. So you didn't really have to press anything, or you just read it. It's right there.
Right,
so but nobody has a compact disc anymore. But if you owned one, it wouldn't be hard to find out who wrote the song, because it's right there on the disc and or in the booklet.
That's true, but that is why halfway through that sentence, realizing that, I said with the press of a button. I ended that sentence with specifically qualifying with the press of a button, because I knew you would actually
covered yourself.
I knew you were going to say, you know, you just look at the liner notes, and I was like, oh no, he's going to bring that up. How do I walk this back in the same sentence without actually, you know, pausing?
You and Neil Portnow need to go to crisis management school. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. I think Neil might need it more than I do right now.
Yes.
Now, remember that Luc Besson film, Michael, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets?
I do.
Yeah, well, we didn't either, actually. I didn't, at least. But the people that invested in it, they sure remember. The most expensive movie of Besson's career, it's also a rare flop for the hugely popular director, costing about $200 million to make and grossing about, well, $200 million worldwide. Well, that's not stopping the French multi-hyphenate, who is in talks with Netflix to fund several projects on tap at his company, EuropaCorp. The deal, covering several films, will see projects limited to the more typical Besson budget of $30 to $50 million. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a big whoop, I should say. One flop should not destroy your career. He's proved got a long track record. It's a smart move by Netflix. So it makes sense for everybody. But certainly after that movie and the company looking like it might have been tanked by one big film, it's good to know that he's back on track and maybe has some funding for some more projects and can show again his commercial viability.
Well, and that's why I would say it's a big deal, because everybody thought, well, that's it. Much like the Golden Compass sank New Line, Valerian is going to sink EuropaCorp, which it was one of the big production companies in Europe. Apparently not, because here comes Netflix to save the day. So that's, to me, why this would be a big deal.
Great.
Publishers Weekly is arguably the most important trade paper in the book industry, and they've just written a call to arms. And that's not a farewell to arms. That was Ernest Hemingway. Okay. In a new editorial, they're calling on publishers to join the fight to defend net neutrality, to turn this from a policy at the whim of the FCC to federal law. They want it to become an actual law and legislation. Librarians are already fighting for net neutrality, as are many groups like PEN America and major authors. But the Association of American Publishers and the multinational companies like Penguin Random House they represent have been conspicuously silent. No more, says Publishers Weekly. You represent a hugely important industry, and your voice is needed. Add it to the voices of librarians, writers, 50 U.S. senators, and 20-plus states suing to defend net neutrality. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal because they are a major voice in the industry, and they are trying to light a fire under publishers. This happened like 10 days ago, and I haven't heard of any response or groundswell of movement by publishers. But I don't understand why every major company other than internet service providers isn't up in arms and calling their congressmen and senators and saying this needs to happen, because it affects every company there is.
Well, and now, of course, you do see certain telcos saying, no, we need net neutrality. But they're saying it kind of like after the horse ran out of the barn. They're like,
oh, after they fought to end it.
Yeah, exactly.
After they fought to end it. Yeah, no, I don't care what they think. I think every Hollywood studio, every music label, every TV station, every network, everybody should be pushing and arguing and yelling about this because it affects all their businesses. It's just bizarre to me that they're not more. I mean, you know, entertainment is the second biggest export of our nation after, you know, defense. It's ahead of food, for heaven's sake. Why they are not up in arms and fighting to make sure this doesn't stand is beyond me.
Well, now, did you read the story about Sonos closing its doors on Grammy Sunday in New York? They have a store in New York. Sonos is a smart speaker, a you know, whole house speaker. You can kind of put them in different rooms and they're wirelessly, you know, you can listen to music wirelessly. It's
right.
It's been around for 10 years. And they're kind of expanding and they have a store now, and they closed their doors on Grammy Sunday, took out a big ad in the New York Times, full page ad. And they said, look, we're doing this to kind of bring attention to the fact that, net neutrality is important.
So what did closing their doors do? Just saying you have no access to our store, just like we won't have access to, you know, was that what the idea is? Symbolic? We're not available?
Totally symbolic. Yeah. And okay. Now keep in mind, this is a company that makes these, you know, receiver speakers that really kind of depend on streaming music, right?
Sure. Because well, sure. So it's in their best interest, as it is for Hollywood and most any other company that uses the internet. Anybody other than an ISP really should agree with Sonos and say they act. Somebody did a great campaign in front of FCC offices on their bicycle. They slowed down on the block in front of the FCC and were slowing traffic as if they were throttling traffic literally in front of the FCC to try and tie up traffic and create a traffic jam by saying, this is what happens when you throttle traffic on the internet. And they're on their bicycles, basically causing a traffic jam in front of the FCC offices.
That was right up until somebody ran them over, at which point the...
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, the publishers need to get together. They're doing that on the man Booker, you know, the Booker Prize, right? That's the biggest award in the UK. And a few years ago, they opened it up to
American authors,
to any title written in English that's published in the UK. It wasn't just American authors, but they opened it up to any author that published in English and had their book published in the UK. That, of course, meant the door was open to American authors. And now a bunch of publishers, like 30 of them, have banded together to say, hey, we've tried this. Bad idea, drop it and go back to what the Booker was, a uniquely UK offering. And the company's pushing back and saying, hey, you know, it's just a few years. Let's relax. It doesn't make sense in this world anymore. We've opened it up to a lot of territories, not just the US. It's just not the Commonwealth anymore. It's anybody who writes in English. Let's give it more time. So we'll see what happens there.
Well, I'm going to jump ahead just to one of these stories that kind of is book related, because the Chinese government is cracking down on Hong Kong publishers again. Gui Minha became a cause celeb with protesters in Hong Kong and the publishing industry worldwide when he and others were seized and held secretly by the Chinese government. Gui was freed but detained in China and forced to report regularly to the police. Gui, you just wanted me to say this word improperly again and again. This poor guy, I'm mispronouncing his name probably five times here. So Gui was on a train with two Swedish diplomats because, you know, he has Swedish citizenship. That didn't stop security officials from seizing him and spiriting him away on Saturday, January 20th. His daughter has not heard from him since. That's a big problem. Big deal or big whoop.
It's a very big deal. It's not a surprise in China. It is not a democracy. It's an authoritarian state. Hopefully people will keep paying attention. The publishing industry rallied around him last time. They need to do it again because he is in danger. And he symbolizes the danger of a very, very nascent free press in Hong Kong, which could, you know, start to have an effect in China. There's a bit of a court system that's showing its own independence. There's a little bit of free press and people on the internet showing independence, but it ain't easy. And you have to fight every time a step back like this occurs.
Well, and I read an article yesterday in the Sunday New York Times about how the publishing industry is booming in Afghanistan.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a very interesting article. And of course, part of that article talks about the piracy that exists, about how even, you know, these publishers will publish a book and they also own bookstores, okay, some of these publishers, and how they are just exasperated over the fact that they will sell 1,000 copies, but the pirates will sell 4,000 copies of their title. Meanwhile, their bookstore that they own is selling pirated copies of books from other publishers because it's the only way for them to stay in business.
Keep going with the books and talk about what's happening at Apple and Walmart.
What is happening at Apple and Walmart? I mean, certainly they're not selling CDs, but books are big business, and some people think Amazon shouldn't be the only one selling them. Walmart is jumping into the ebook business by partnering with e-reader company Kobo, and as I say that, I say, oh, they're still around? And Apple is determined to revamp their digital bookstore by hiring away a top executive from Amazon and doing major overhaul of their anemic digital bookstore. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a very big deal. I think, they need more players. You don't want Amazon being the only game in town, just like they're about to be the only game for compact discs, that's for sure. But until publishers demand an open source ebook standard that so anybody who buys an ebook from anywhere can read it on any device, they're really hurting themselves. So that's a big step they need to take. It's a big whoop until they actually push for something like that. So buying a book on Amazon doesn't mean you're stuck with just the Kindle.
Right. And of course, publishers wanted to set the price, right? Remember this whole thing that we went through, a couple years back? Right. And they said, we want $15, $15.99, because we want to push people to buy the physical copy. And Amazon said, listen, if you do that, we know from eons of experience, we have so much experience in this area, you will sell fewer books. Okay. That's just the way it's going to be. You will sell fewer books.
Well, they'll make less money. I mean, of course, they'll sell fewer books, but if they made more money, they wouldn't care.
Right.
The point was that you'll make more money overall if you have this price point that we suggest.
Well, and to your point, there is a couple of online course, there's hundreds of them, it seems like, where you can kind of, Coursera and Udemy or all of these different places where you can take online courses. And every once in a while, they'll have a sale where, an HTML or a web programming or a web development course is $10. It's $10. And I'll go and I'll pay for it. It's $10. And I'll think, hey, maybe if I take that course, I can finally figure out how to put a donate button on the Showbiz Sandbox website. And so I'll pay for it. And then I'll never actually take the course, right? And so I would agree that if books were like $7.99, $8.99, $9.99, I would just, make a spontaneous purchase. I might never read the book, but I make the purchase.
Well, I certainly have piles of books that I haven't read yet. I think the point is that what they did stupidly was make the ebook more expensive than the hardcover, more expensive than the paperback. And that just boggles the mind. That is illogical. Whether the hardback should be 18 and the ebook should be 12, or the hardback should be 20 and the ebook should be 15. I don't know, but making you pay more for ebook was really stupid. That hasn't stopped it from becoming the most popular format for new releases. New books, fiction, nonfiction, popular books that you go to see in the bookstore. We're not talking about cookbooks. We're not talking about picture books for kids, but basic general fiction and nonfiction. Ebooks are still the most popular format. So, they need to wise up.
Well, speaking of lowering costs and selling more, here's a story from the world of sports. In Atlanta, a massively expensive new football stadium has opened, as opposed to all of those, cheap football stadiums. Normally, fans would stream in, admire the splashy interior, and then get sticker shock over $8 sodas and $12 hamburgers. Not this time. The home of the NFL's Atlanta Falcons and Major League Soccer's Atlanta United actually lowered concession prices by about 50% compared to the old stadium. We're talking $2 hot dogs and $5 cheeseburgers. And guess what? Fans spent more money than they did before, with revenue jumping 16%. Of course, ticket prices are still sky high. As one concessions expert put it, you could give the food and soda away for free, frankly. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a smart thing. And in fact, they do give away concessions for free when you sit in the really expensive seats.
Yes.
You do have access to free soda and hamburgers, not free beer, mind you, not free liquor, but all the other stuff. So they actually could do that. But look, it's smart. This is what Hollywood needs to look at when they're looking at movie theaters. The theater chains have wildly overpriced soda. I go to the movies for free and MoviePass says, oh, well, you're spending more on concessions. No, I'm not, because I still feel like an idiot when I spend $8 for a damn soda that's three times the size that I want. Give me the little baby size, I ask, and they give me something the size of an oil tanker. So it's, it's too much soda. I don't want it. They still don't really have good, fresh, healthy alternatives. They've expanded their options a little bit, but they should be good quality, not all junk food, and less expensive. It shouldn't cost more than a ticket. They still don't know that, and they're really screwing themselves over.
Well, that's a subject unto itself, but that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. And as promised at the top of the show, we're going to be talking about the Super Bowl. Ratings were 110 million, I guess, right? Did that come in officially?
No, they're still figuring out the numbers and, you know, streaming and stuff like that. But it's going to be slightly less than the last year or two. But it's still massive, massive amount of people watching.
And did you watch the Super Bowl?
I watched it on rerun, on fast pace. I didn't watch the game per se. I checked the scores just because it was kind of exciting because the score kept going back and forth. No defense at that Super Bowl. But I did watch all the ads. I don't know why, but I did. Probably because there were so many movie ads. I was just intrigued to see them. So I checked them out and found them all pretty shoulder shrugging, I guess is the way to put it.
Yes. Well, later today, I'm going to be writing for Celluloid Junkie a piece on how those movie ads did on Facebook, on Twitter. I'm hoping to get quarter by quarter ratings so that I could say, here's how many people watched a potential, an ad for Mission Impossible during the second quarter. And here's how many Facebook streams they had. And here's how many, you know, social comments they had on Twitter and Facebook, et cetera. And that was put together by ComScore, UTA, and Tubular. And it was fascinating to see all of that information. And I hope to talk to Paul DeGarabedian about it later today. But you didn't find any of that information or any of those trailers interesting.
No. I, the trailers are a totally different issue. It's like that those are sort of separate from the ads that they create for the Super Bowl. So I thought some trailers were fine or whatever. That, you know, the Han Solo one, they teased the actual trailer, which online was pretty interesting. So, you know, but yeah, the trailers were fine. Lots of movies. What I found interesting, well, I hated basically the social media. If you want to talk about the actual ads, I just found it so infuriating when they're like, oh, you bought a Hyundai and you helped kids with cancer. It's like, no, that is actually not true. You know, yes. And someone said, why didn't Hyundai spend the millions of dollars on the ad and donate that to kids' cancer? You know, so anyway, but every time they try to, you know, co-opt something and say, oh, we're Verizon. Thank your first responders because, you know, we help them connect the call. It's like, no. Verizon, your company that charges me for my cell phone for service. You're not a fireman saving lives. You know, and the worst was the Martin Luther King one, Dodge Ram trucks, but, you know, buy a truck because Martin Luther King, you know, it's like, oh, my God, I thought that was insane. I just thought one after the other I found really offensive. I don't know what it is, but these are like, I have no interest in hearing you claim that your multinational corporation is somehow involved in good work. You're not.
Well, and I was at a Super Bowl party. So not only did I miss like half the game because, you know, you're just, I don't know. You're just like talking to somebody or you're just not paying attention until, of course, the very end when it came down to the last throw. Mm-hmm. But I mean, some of the ads I'd seen already, you know, you see them on YouTube or.
Yeah, they leak them now. Yeah. What can you do?
Yeah. And they said they weren't going to do that this year, but in the end, they did. I thought that the Amazon ad was cute.
Which one? You mean the Alexa ad?
Oh, don't say the A name. Oh. You just said everybody. You know, actually, that's kind of funny that you should mention that because a couple things about that ad. They had to notch the audio there so that they took out certain frequency ranges when that name was mentioned. When the
it wouldn't trick. Oh, that's funny.
And what they did was they notched it so they took out whole bands of frequencies so that it wouldn't trigger the Amazon Echo devices in everybody's homes when they were watching the Super Bowl. But what I found interesting is they probably should not have done that. They could have actually done a study on how many how many Echoes went off, and they could have done a demographic, you know, they could have known.
Or they should have had some trigger that when it happened at that time, because they knew when they were going to do the ad, that it would trigger her saying something in your home. But that would be creepy. It would be like you two dumping their album onto your phone. So actually people might not have liked that or found it clever. They'd be like, oh, wow, Amazon is controlling the thing in my home. Maybe I don't like that.
Well, not only that, but I'm sure there was some question of, well, let's see, we've sold, you know, 75 million of these. And if 100 million people are watching the Super Bowl and we get 50 million requests all at the same time from the Amazon Echo, wow, we could really like bring down our own site.
What did you watch the halftime show, or was you still chatting away with people?
No, actually, that was one of those things where even the kids at this party were like, okay, we want to see the show, we want to see the show. And then I think when they were watching it, they were like, what are we watching? Like, who is this guy Justin Timberlake? Because, you know, Justin Timberlake, they were like, what's in sync? And I was like,
well, no, he's a big star. He's still a big
star. He's a big star to you, me.
No.
But he's somebody who's 10 star. Years old, they don't.
Well, they don't know who anybody is. Maybe they don't know who Bruno Mars or Lorde is, but that doesn't mean anything.
Oh, they know who Bruno Mars is. They know who Bruno Mars is.
Justin Timberlake is a big pop star. He does an album 2-3 years ago. He's not a nobody. He's not grandpa's act.
No. But they knew the one song, you know, the dance,
except
dance, dance.
In my pocket.
Yeah.
No, I thought the whole performance was deeply unimpressive and dull, you know, just choreographed and dull and boring. And he barely sang a single note live. It was just boring.
Yeah, he sang the stuff at the piano live with Prince, and that was like a big controversy. You know, Prince being a hologram.
It wasn't a hologram. It was just projected onto a screen, so it wasn't controversial.
Yeah, well,
people had
the
rumor that it was going to be a hologram, but it wasn't. It was just an image of him on a sheet.
Yeah, and I thought actually that was a really amazing moment because they cut to the outside of the stadium, and all of the lights around the stadium became purple in the shape of the Prince logo.
I didn't know whether they actually did that or whether that was just a digital effect.
I wondered that myself, and I was going to go today and try and look that up, because if they were able to pull that off, wow, that would have been amazing, because they would have had to coordinate that with every building in the neighborhood for like, you know, 2-3 miles.
I don't think it was that big of a logo. Miles?
Yeah, well, yeah, because you could see downtown.
It was I don't think it was that impressive or interesting, and it might have just been digitally, but whatever. But the reason we're talking about the Super Bowl is because when you track the ads and track the things that are happening, you can see changes in industry and culture, like, of course, the rise of movie and TV ads and the rise of internet companies like Monster.com. And this year, it really was unbelievably telling how there was just a flood of streaming services.
Oh, my God, yes.
I mean, it started with the pregame show being sponsored by YouTube TV, and it never stopped. There were ads for shows on Hulu, ads for shows on Netflix, ads for shows on Amazon Prime. It just was on and on and on, and I thought that was really telling. These things holding their own with, you know, TV shows and movies, you know, trailers, you know, they looked indistinguishable. And the idea of people thinking, yeah, that's in a theater, this is on a TV, that's on my streaming service, it's all the same to people. And in fact, Netflix had an ad for The Cloverfield Paradox, a movie that they snatched up that had already been made, and they debuted on streaming service right after the game. People could watch it right away. It's already got really bad reviews. Apparently, Netflix will be the home of really bad studio tentpole flicks. You know, the Will Smith film Bright, and now they picked up this movie, also terrible reviews. But I guess, you know, you're at home, you whatever. It's just like the way people would rent DVDs, like, oh, I've heard of that. And they would rent a movie they knew wasn't going to be that good. And it drove me nuts. It's like, why are you renting this film? I know you saw an ad for it 3 months ago, but why are you renting this film? You have no expectation this will be a good movie. I'm like, well, it'll be okay. And now that's what Netflix is. It'll be all right. Watch The Cloverfield Paradox, whatever.
Well, that's basically what it's become, right? I mean, it's basically become like, oh, what's on Netflix? I guess I'll watch this.
Oh, my gosh. They even had an ad for Amazon Fire TV. And I was like, is that still a thing?
Oh, my God. Yes, absolutely. Google Chrome. Yeah.
Well, Chromecast. Google, okay. Fire TV. I didn't know that was still happening. But, you know, the Jack Ryan show on Amazon Prime, the Cloverfield Paradox on Netflix. What was the show on Hulu?
I have no idea.
Yeah, there was a show early on that Hulu was promoting. It's just, you know, and ads for Verizon, you know, which is sort of like your streaming service carrier linking themselves to every good deed in the world. But it really felt like the year of, you know, the streaming services coming into their own and being there, right? Nobody even thinks about it. It's perfectly normal. And they are competitors. I keep thinking Netflix isn't really a competitor for it, but they are. You know, there's only so much attention. There's only so much money people have. And if they pay for Netflix, they may not be paying for HBO or something else. So people have to make a choice. And Netflix is now a big choice that people are making. And so when you're Hollywood saying you want to get people to come to the movie every month or so, you know, hey, they can just watch it for free on Netflix. That gets harder and harder to compete with. So everybody's clawing their way. Everybody wants attention. And the streaming services really came into their own at this Super Bowl.
Well, you know, I always go back to, I think it was like, God, it must have been like 6-7 years ago, maybe even, 7 years ago, when somebody from HBO told me about Netflix. They said, you know, Netflix keeps claiming they're not a competitor of mine, but don't keep taking my content. Don't keep taking my, you know.
Well, they pay for it.
No, what they're saying is don't take the content that I'm trying to acquire, the films, the documentaries that I'm trying to acquire, and then tell me you're not a competitor.
Right, exactly. And YouTube did that. They just signed a deal. YouTube TV signed a deal for a new LA soccer team, and they'll also get the naming rights to the team. And you could see in their ad before the game, they sponsored the pregame show, YouTube TV, and they focused on the fact that they are carrying live sporting events like the Super Bowl and like soccer. So, you know, they're pushing that hard. So, you know, they are fighting for content. There's no doubt about that. Well, obviously, we didn't have much to say this week. It was a very slow week as everybody waited for the Super Bowl. Next 2 weeks may be slow because we've got the Olympics coming up.
Yeah.
But, you know, for inside baseball, I think Hollywood can see, yeah, they are competitors because look at that. Their ads are running right opposite your TV shows and your movies, and they look just as good, you know. And so people say, hey, should I go see Mission Impossible or should I watch Jack Ryan, you know? So yeah, you get they're on your back, they're on your trail. You got to watch out for them.
Well, and if you were going to watch Glee, you might see star Mark Salling, who died at the age of 35. That moves us into our obituary section.
That's right. The Glee was a big hit a few years ago. It's you know, came and fell, spawned a lot of stars. But you know, you're on a hit show. Sometimes it's more than some people can handle. You know, you think you've got it made, but it's not a curse. Let's not be glib about it. But you know, actor Corey Monteith had trouble. He overdosed and died. And now actor Mark Salling died. Apparently, he tried to kill himself a number of times in the past. He was found guilty of possessing kiddie porn. He faced prison and having to register as a sex offender for the rest of his life. And he took his own life at the age of 35. So a very sad thing for Glee. And for those actors who sometimes fame, you know, it's what you think you want. It can be really, really hard to deal with. Other people deal with fame really well, like Temptations lead singer Dennis Edwards. He stepped into the group when they fired David Ruffins. I forget why. I meant to look that up. But he joined the Temptations when they were a huge, huge act back in 1968. And he was with them for 9 years and then on and off reunions after that. But he's the voice you hear on I Can't Get Next to You, Ball of Confusion, Psychedelic Shack, which I love, and Papa Was a Rolling Stone. He was born right near me in Fairfield, Alabama. And he died at the age of 74. So a big Motown star who joined that group at the peak of their fame and helped them continue it into the late 70s. So he's a big figure in popular music.
Well, before we push this show to an hour and a half, which is our custom, I'm going to say, hey, you know what? You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to our show. You can rate and review our show. And please do. It does help us out when you do. You can find that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where you can find us. And again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT, who have their own website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
FreeGui.com.
And hopefully that's the right pronunciation of Gui's name. But if it's not, you can find all of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry at his, now I guess all of his work is aggregated at MichaelGiltz.com.
It's certainly not, it's still on Huffington Post in their database. They're leaving all that stuff up there because it can still get traffic.
That's true. And of course, you know, don't forget to check out BookFilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.